The following podcast contains mature language and spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
I don't know that horror necessarily works in comics because it's such an inherently visual medium and a static one. It's really hard to get to a place of fear in this medium. I think there's a reason why scary stories are so often associated with like live oral readings or around a campfire where you're already in a circumstance where you might feel vulnerable. There's an element of sensory deprivation. You know, you're in this darkness. You don't know what's just beyond that lit area. You're focusing really on one sense largely. And that kind of focus makes you conscious of the absence of your other senses, the absence of your scope of perception. So for me personally, I find that audio is the most fearsome storytelling medium. When you're driving down a road alone, listening to something on the radio, of a song that maybe messes with your head, or a podcast, some sort of narrative piece, again, you're vulnerable, you're isolated. And also, if the story is being told well, you're getting drawn into the story. And so that's disorienting, because if even for a moment you go out of the story, you realize that you haven't been paying attention and the story is telling you the consequences of not paying attention. You're being set up to fail and be fearful. Movies can certainly do the same job. Again, the focus is even more, I think, on what's being passively received. And because you have multiple senses laser focused, the realization that you're not paying attention to other things around you can be even more pronounced. But there is a greater sense of time constraints with movies. And in fact, I think sometimes the lack of time constraints on things like television can hurt as well, because you have that diminished intensity. But obviously, movies can be scary too. I just think that maybe not as scary as a pure audio. Also, I think that fiction can be very scary, because again, while you may not have anything going on in the ears, prose has a direct connection to the brain. You're manifesting what you're reading inside your mind. And regardless of what's on the written page, your mind is necessarily filling out details that aren't present on the page. So I think the skewing of a reality is perhaps more pronounced in prose, even though you would think that'd be the safest venue because there's no jump scares on the printed page, for instance. So in that respect, to some degree, comic books are the worst of all horror world, because you're reliant upon an artist to render something not only in a static image, which can be more effective, but also in sequential images on the page, you know, trying to tell a story through this collection of static images. It's kind of hard for anything to reach out and grab you or really shock you. You're constantly getting spoiled by the turn of each page. If the placement of a particular image or element isn't done just right, then it's just not going to have the punch that would be desirable. In my experience, as much as I love comic books, you're not necessarily as engrossed in a comic book as you are in other media. It doesn't capture the attention the same way. The pacing is much different, especially as a veteran comic book reader. I exert a lot of control over how I receive the material because I've been doing it for so long that I can take it slow, I can become more engrossed, but typically I can stop pretty much at any time and go off and do something else and then come back to it. You're not trapped in the same way that you are in a more passive medium where there's a greater control over how you experience things, in what time frame and what sequence and what environment. Let's face it, if I'm reading a comic book, I'm probably in a well-lit room. Even if I'm on a tablet or a computer screen, I'm probably in a place that's secured, locked, that kind of thing. So while I'm a guy who likes horror elements, because I don't think horror is necessarily super effective in comic books, I'm not necessarily drawn to horror comics. And also as a kid, I really wasn't that into true horror anyway. More that Universal Monsters grotesquery thing. I liked superheroes with elements of horror mixed in. Vampires and werewolves and Frankenstein type creatures and stuff. So my natural inclinations was more toward Marvel. And in particular, when I was a kid, I bought a comic book, I think it was Marvel Premiere, and I believe it was titled League of Monsters, where they teamed up Werewolf by Night, Morbius, Ghost Rider, Man-Thing, up against some sort of weird Roman god alien creature, probably riffing off of a Jim Steranko, Nick Fury story from the better part of a decade earlier. Because comic books are definitely optimized for superheroes at this point, now it's almost the entire focus of mainstream mainstream comics. That's the thing that they do the best, and I love that thing. So if you take that and add elements of another thing I love, horror, I'm going to be more inclined to dig on it. Where I think comic books often are the worst with horror, because again, since you're not going to spend a lot of time with imperiled characters, especially in a time frame like the 70s going backward, lots of short stories, you're really just seeing victims, or you're seeing circumstances set up for the protagonist to be punished for their crimes, that sort of thing. Point being is that I'm not super into horror stories in comics. DC did a lot of anthology material where it wasn't about ongoing narratives. It wasn't about things that necessarily took place in their shared universe of concepts. So there was just a lot of poor man's EC going on there, and it wasn't necessarily my draw. Now that I'm 8+ years into podcasting, often struggling to get out an episode on a given week, I wonder about how we were able to get out one particular show, Marvel Superheroes Podcast, on a weekly basis for probably the first few years of our podcasting. And part of it is, of course, just the evolution of what we try to do. Back in those early days, we tended to spend 30 to 45 minutes often on a single comic book or with vague recollections of one particular property. I didn't have as high and aspirations, and I was obviously more passionate about the material and had a more ready familiarity with it as I've wanted to go deeper into research. If I want to do a podcast retrospective on continuity comics, company that I only read, you know, spotty images, issues of here and there, I have to actually bear down and do some proper reading, and it just takes time and effort. So it's a lot harder to do a 90-minute, two-hour show covering numerous issues or decades worth of output of a company versus what we were doing in those early days. And it's funny going back and looking at the early Who's Editing, and it's the same situation. It's like I've gotten further and further behind on doing my little comment game, which is ridiculous because, again, it's a series of posts on a comment board. Why should this take so long? Why should this be so increasingly difficult? It's like, well, you have months and months of accumulated lore, oftentimes riffing on things that wasn't intended to be long-term ideas, sustainable ideas in the first place. And also look at these early entries, and they're usually a few sentences at most, 2-3 sentences, without a clear idea of where any of the material that I'm alluding to is going to be going. So of course, it's going to get harder and harder to herd those kittens, just like with the podcast. But a clear turning point is volume 5. That was the issue featuring the Clayfaces. And I loathe the concept of Clayface. I believe the Clayface was featured in one of the early episodes of Batman the Animated Series, and among the first that I hated. I don't like Batman when he gets outside of that more grounded, realistic environment. I don't like man bats. I don't like play faces. I feel like that's getting into a Spider-Man place with Batman. I just like Batman to be Batman. I like him to be a detective. I like him to fight crazy people and thieves and not be flying on somebody's back or having essentially Sandman mud monster attacking him. I don't mind some of the earlier incarnations where their touch melts flesh or they're able to shapeshift to be chameleonic, referencing another Spider-Man villain. That's still reasonable. It still works. I feel like guys like Clayface are more concept breakers. I don't know how much detective work goes into dealing with a mud monster. It feels more like that's an action story, and I'm not as into those with Batman. Martial arts, yeah, but throwing batarangs at a mud creature who absorbs it and spits it back out again, no. But I went all in on Clayfaces because there were multiple ones in the issue. They were basically talking about the mud pack, and I decided to exploit that for the purposes of the game. I'd already set up that the League of Assassins and Ra's al Ghul had moved into Gotham and were killing off rogues and basically trying to take over the city. I hadn't done a whole lot with it, though, up to that point. And I had this idea, wouldn't it be cool to pit all of the DC Comics intelligence agencies against one another and basically have those agencies destroyed through the manipulations of the League of Assassins? I did not know at that time, and upon initiating that idea, that the same basic premise was already being explored by Brian Michael Bendis and his Leviathan Rising stories and for the Superman line of books. I didn't stumble upon that until I started doing more research, which again was not something I was concerned about in the earlier days of Who's Editing. As I did more research, I recognized some of those redundancies and tried to shift it somewhat, but I was still somewhat married to the idea of having all these agencies fighting each other and getting destroyed ultimately. And the easy place to do that, to explore that, was in Gotham City. And because I had all these damn clay faces around, the angle that I came up with is, what have you infected? The Clayface
cases with communicable disease that would do damage to members of these agencies. And so you come up with some MacGuffin. I think in this case, it was that either they were trying to get them for Lazarus pits or some other such nonsense. But basically you set it up where you give the agencies incentive to pursue the various play faces who had all been infected with this communicable disease. They would then take back to the agencies and would kill them from within through disease. I was also doing this in September of 2020, so we're already many months into the corona pandemic. And so it's like, well, you know, it's obviously ever present on everyone's mind anyway. Let's play around with some bio horror, why don't we? And it'll give me something to do with all these goddamn stupid fucking clay faces that I never could fucking stand in the first freaking place. Now, one thing I did like, though, as a kid, is I picked up this extra-size reprint edition of Swamp Thing Stories by Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson. Obviously, these were guys at the peak of their powers doing material that was so resonant that it's still in print today, still being riffed on today. It's also one of those rare instances where DC comes out triumphant in a head-to-head because, I'm sorry, even with Mike Ploog, Man-Thing's just never stacked up Swamp Thing. But that having been said, my Swamp Thing reading is limited. I've done some of the Alan Moore stuff, which is, you know, required at this point for anybody reads comic books. But I've never was a huge Alan Moore guy, so I haven't done tons and tons of reading on that. I've read through a couple of trades. I'm not sure that I ever read any of the Wein Wrightson material beyond that collected edition, even though I liked it, but I just never felt compelled to read beyond because it feels like those earlier stories are the best stuff anyway. And they introduce Anton Arcane in those early stories, and it's an old man seeking immortality, does a body switch with Swamp Thing for that one issue. I guess because he was introduced early on and because the whole mad scientist motif works well with that type of character, they kept revisiting Anton Arcane over and over again. He's basically the Lex Luthor to Swamp Thing. And because they're horror comics, his representation became more and more macabre. You know, at one point he goes to hell and he has demonic aspects, and you know, it's visually, it's cool. I like seeing the guy as like this deformed spider creature and stuff, but not having necessarily read the stories in which that imagery is derived and not necessarily being geared for if I were to read it, I don't have a ton of use for Anton Arcane. And so when Siskoid started, who's editing, really usage of the character was down to the pun. You've got Arcane, you've got Arkham Asylum. Why don't we just marry these two things together and riff off of that? What if a guy like Anton Arcane ran Arkham Asylum? It'd probably be something like Hellraiser 2 Hellbound, where you've got somebody who has an outsized control over a vulnerable population, while also noting that that vulnerable population also has elements of danger and inducement of fear in the common peoples and stuff. Let's be honest, asylums, especially asylums before reformations went into place in the 80s and 90s, mostly the 90s, were some scary, scary ass places. So it's just a natural for horror stories. That was just the seeming to me to be obvious riff. And since so many of the initial properties proposed in that first Who's Editing were just puns, that's what I went for. And then I'm kind of stuck with it, and it ends up influencing everything that comes after. But instead, we had the three Titans titles, which included Legion Lost. And Legion Lost really ran off the rails by the end there. Somehow, they managed to involve Captain Atom, spelled A-D-Y-M, if I recall correctly, at some point at the end of the Captain Atom New 52 launch, which might as well just call it the Dr. Manhattan series. That's essentially what they were going for. At the end of that series, they shoot at Captain Atom forward in time, and he's depowered in the 30th century. Somehow, incredulously, he gets involved with the science police. I don't know why in a super futuristic society you would allow some bizarro derelict with no history whatsoever that anybody can ascertain be not only a member of the science police, but actually a leader in a covert branch called Echo. Echo were sort of like the time police, maybe a variation on the Linear Men. The Linear Men, I think, are somewhat modern centric in the DC continuity, but they police the entirety of the time stream. And so here you have Captain Atom and Echo doing it from the thousand-year perspective, doing essentially the same thing that the Linear Men had done. I'm not even sure there are Linear Men in the New 52 anymore. But he is involved with sending the team of Legion Lost back in time. They're supposed to stop some world-ending event, which appears to happen before the end of the series. They got 16 issues to get to that point. He does have an embedded agent within the Team Titans, Chameleon Girl, and he has two members of that team that he believes are fated to die in that time period. period, Wildfire and Tyrock. There's a big thing where Tyrock is beloved by his people in part because he's supposed to die in the 21st century. And then they find a component of one of Wildfire's uniforms that's supposed to confirm his death. But by the end of the series, neither Tyrock nor Wildfire is dead. And this team, which includes Dawnstar, Gates, Timberwolf, they're all still stuck in the past on a book that ended in 2013, and they are never considered again after that point. It's seriously like they're stranded 7 years ago at the time of this recording, almost 8 years ago now. No, sorry, literally 8 years ago now because of the cover date, and nothing is ever done with them. They're just completely forgotten. I do think that the characters have been revised in the Brian Michael Bendis Legion series. At least some of them, I think, have appeared there, but it's never addressed the 2013 New 52 incarnation of this team. But what ends up happening is they save the Earth from a supposed extinction-level event that only some Ravagers are also involved in. They couldn't even spring for the Teen Titans. And none of these mysteries are resolved. Why is Captain Atom involved with the 30th century? Nothing becomes of that. At one point, you have two versions of Gate. One version who had a scarred face, one who didn't. And they kind of pay that off in the finale. But these guys are all just stood floating around, and they no longer have any impact on the DC Universe after this point. And frankly, they didn't have an impact at the time either. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten their series canceled. And so once again, DC overestimates the appeal of the Legion of Superheroes and tries to increase their appeal by having them involved with the 20th or 21st century adventures, and it doesn't amount to anything. The Legion of Superheroes inarguably influenced the creation of the all-new, all-different X-Men, but they've never been able to catch that lightning in a bottle. The closest they ever got was in the 70s and 80s. And DC's been trying to recapture that lightning ever since and failing miserably. Ever since the Baxter format experiment, I think that they've never been able to recover from, again, that hubris, that notion that you could create an overpriced, higher-end title for the direct market, and then a year later sell the leftovers to the mainstream audience on the newsstand. Ultimately, they just killed the interest in that book on the newsstand, and especially when it comes to what were bestsellers for them, helping to kill the newsstand, and certainly helping to kill DC's presence on the newsstand as they're continually pushed out in that time period by first Marvel and then later Image. So riffing on the Man Thing Swamp Thing deal, I'm a big proponent in don't DC my Marvel, don't Marvel my DC. I realize that in the grand scheme of things, DC and Marvel might as well be Delta and United or what have you. It's basically two companies manufacturing the same type of product. So all they really care about is market share and profits at the corporate level. And the easiest way to do that is to look at what the other guy's doing that's successful and copy that. If this is doing well, make that, regardless of whether or not it worked within the creative context of your universe, whether or not it undermines its integrity. But the simple fact is, each of these universes are defined by a series of constructs. The things that are successful at one company don't necessarily translate to success at another company. And even when you have two similar products, there needs to be differences between the two of them just for them to work within the context in which they exist. I think a really good for instance of that is that Marvel is very a-religious. I would argue agnostic. There is a acknowledgement of mythical, mystical forces within that universe, but there's a historic aversion to defining those forces, especially in terms that are recognizable as modern religious. And despite being junk science, Marvel ultimately is still centered on pseudoscience. It's centered on a semblance of reality. Everything attempts to have a rational explanation, even when it doesn't really bear up, the science doesn't bear up. Spider-Man isn't Flyman. He doesn't have a ring that was given to him by a sorcerer that allows him to change from one form to another form. He was bitten by a radioactive spider. What does that mean? Really nothing. I mean, literally, we see the spider irradiated and then immediately bites Spider-Man. There wouldn't really even be time for tumors, cancers, mutations, whatever to have happened in the spider for them to be able to transmit that to Peter Parker. But in its time period, to its audience, it seemed reasonable. If you want the realistic take on that, go read Warren Ellis's Ruins. It's a very provocative two-part bookshelf series, but you can't build a universe out of that because, spoiler, everybody dies horribly by the end of it. DC Comics is inherently religious. And it's funny because the industry, by and large, especially in the early decades, was defined by Jewish creators and Jewish sensibilities. There's a lot of overlap with Christianity because a lot of American Judaism is of the Reform stripe. A lot of it is descended from the school of Hillel. Hillel teachings were mirrored by Jesus Christ. And so a lot of those elements of social justice and civic responsibility that were instilled in American Jews also overlap into Christianity. So there is a compatibility there. And the Jewishness isn't as overt, especially in the earlier years. Stan Lee over at Marvel injected a greater liberalism in his strain of morality tales at Marvel. But Stan was also a rationalist and a populist. He would take moral stances, but he also tried to be as agreeable as possible. I really think that it was people like Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby that probably forced some of the stronger sociopolitical stances into their comics than Stan would have if left to his own devices. If left to his own devices, there probably wouldn't be comic books, or they'd all be Patsy and Hetty instead. Where at DC, you had, I would say, a greater mingling of religion and ethnicity than at Marvel. And so you had more varying levels of tolerance for expression of religiosity. But most specifically, Judeo-Christian beliefs were forefronted. You know, they weren't necessarily going to turn up in, say, a Superman story, which had two Jewish creators for the first several years of its existence. And again, these were people who came out of sci-fi and the pulps. So they were also, like Stan Lee, more rationalist, more science-minded, even though their command of science was somehow even worse than Stan Lee's. But one of the creators of Superman also created the Spectre, very explicitly a quote-unquote Old Testament style rendition of an angelic figure, considered the literal embodiment of the wrath of God, and that's G-D for Jerry Siegel. Even when characters have fairly explicit biblical grounding, take for instance Ghost Rider, who has ties to Mephisto, who is supposed to be a demon from hell, that's all been rationalized that hell isn't the metaphysical realm that it's viewed as in religious terms. It's actually a parallel dimension that just resembles the conception of a prosecutorial afterlife for people of a certain religious stripe. The Asgardians aren't gods at Marvel. They're super advanced aliens whose seeming magic is actually a technology that's just beyond our ken. Angel and the Ape, fun name, cute premise. The 60s stuff that I tried to skim through didn't do much for me. I read the Vertigo, I think it was Vertigo miniseries that came out in the aughts. That was okay. It's one of those things where I like the premise, but in execution, not seemingly much has been done with it. When you've got an Art Adams cover on a book, you really expect something special, and it just never really got over. But I have used the characters as part of my revised Challengers of the Unknown premise. I try to give them more recognizable faces and basically create a space for these characters that don't necessarily fit well in other books, or supporting characters that outgrew that role and need a place to be active as more protagonist type characters. So I've had fun. It's a gorilla that runs a detective agency with his own little personal Matty Hayes. I think maybe if he had a little bit more of a David Addison vibe, I'd enjoy him more, but it's mostly just sort of the protector type guy. He's watching out for the girl detective. It's fine, but it's a little tired. At DC, no. There's Angel. There's God. There was one Superman story where he essentially meets God, and where Marvel's cosmology is all about Eternals and Watchers and vague cosmic concepts, DC consistently features stuff from straight out of various Bibles. They have explicit Judeo-Christian Islamic morality and iconography, and so that willingness to go to a place that's deeply meaningful to people allows them to explore territory of sophisticated readers material and horror material that Marvel really doesn't have the stomach for. You know, for a little while they did stuff like the Max line where they would do caca, poopy, dick titty type stuff, but never really got into anything significant in terms of essential beliefs and the essential character of man, where DC, even before they created a mature readers line because the mainstream books couldn't tolerate the level of sophistication that was being directed towards by creators like Alan Moore. Vertigo, once it started in the early 90s, was just a codification of something that was already happening at DC in the 80s, and that has gone into the present. Now they have their Black Label books. DC has always had stuff that was R-rated plus for more mature readers that would explore territories that Marvel was never comfortable with, and that even manifests in the movies. The only R-rated Marvel movies were done by Fox, and it seems very unlikely to me that they're going to continue to do any R-rated type material, because they'd much rather have all their Marvel stuff at Disney Plus, which is explicitly maximum PG-13, with a very specifically American-centric aversion to nudity over violence and cursing, whereas DC, owned by Warner Brothers, is still trying to capitalize on its willingness to go R-rated with mainstream characters. I mean, these are the guys who put out unrated cuts of movies starring Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, which, to my thinking, is stupid. It's just extraordinarily stupid. Just like the ongoing burning fanboy need to have Batman movies be R-rated. It's Batman. How seriously can you take this stuff? Guys, come on. Guy who dresses up as a bat and punches people with mental health issues and seek upward economic mobility through theft. And Batman will never not be targeted toward kids and targeted towards selling action figures and play sets and t-shirts. It will never not be for children. Why do you need to do pornographic stuff with children's characters? What is wrong with you? Grow the fuck up. Maybe buy a Vertigo thing instead. Calendar Man's a dumb character with an ugly costume, just all around stupid. My usage of him in Who's Editing was as a long setup for a tampon joke involving Batwoman, because his costume's red and white. I just have no use for this guy. I think he's perfectly fine as an Easter egg in the Suicide Squad. Gets Sean Gunn some work, whatever, who cares? Calendar Man. Calendar Girl's right there, you dumbasses. I love my Calendar Girl every day of the year. So this is all a long-winded way of saying that because DC is willing to go places that Marvel isn't, it's one of DC's strengths to do that and to let Marvel have its things and let DC have its things. And one of the things that DC can do is do gonzo goofy stuff that Marvel can't. That's how you end up with a Batmite. But having been an advocate for that, I just have no tolerance for Batmite. That's part of an era of Batman in which the character was so far afield from the things that work for that character that he had some of the lowest sales of his career, especially relative to other comic book characters. In the 1950s, Batman was just continuing to exist subsistently. I mean, there was a time period where they talked about canceling Batman comics, and a lot of that came from this decades-long period under the editorship of Jack Schiff, when Mort Weisinger exerted undue influence over the editorial office, kept insisting that Batman stories should be more like Superman stories, even though the character isn't built for that. Batmite is just a ripoff of Superman's Mr. Mixius Piddalick. It doesn't fit within the milieu of Gotham City and the types of Batman stories that most people want to read. And that's an instance of Superman DCing my Batman. So I don't care for that character. I don't have much use for that character. That's an instance where it's a very DC thing to do with a character that arguably is the more Marvel type character within the DC universe. There's always been the gag where they should have Captain America come to the DC universe and Batman go to the Marvel universe. I think that's just an instance where Batman is the best at doing what Batman does, and so since Marvel wants to have a hegemony on everything, their fans are like, okay, that's the one character we'd like to take from DC, and we're willing to sacrifice Captain America to do that. Cap is, of course, a very DC type of character. He would have fit in perfectly with the Justice Society of America. They've never had the clearest of leaders, and the closest in terms of figureheads would be Superman, I would say. They've tried to make Alan Moore sort of this chairman type person, but the Justice Society has always felt like a bunch of soloists who get together at a clubhouse and hang out, and then especially if you go back to the old Justice Society stories, they go off on, they either pair up or they have individual missions, and they all get together to talk to each other about how it went. You know, they're not a team in the more common sense like the Avengers or the Justice League of America. The problem, of course, being that one of the things that makes Cap so integral to the Marvel Universe is he's the one guy who is very DC within a universe in which that's not the norm. If he were at DC, he'd be kind of boring. Aside from being a clear, obvious person to lead the Justice Justice Society, more so than, say, an Alan Scott or a Hawkman. He would just be the best of a whole slew of characters that DC already has that does sort of the same thing, where there just aren't a lot of guys like that at Marvel, and especially guys that are still present in the modern era, because Marvel more or less abandoned their 1940s characters. Even in the 1960s, they repurposed the names in the same way that DC had, but without ever really strongly reaching back to that legacy. And because Marvel is perpetually mooring their characters within contemporary times, this is a company where Reed and Ben Grimm were World War II veterans, and then they were Korean War veterans, and they just kept shifting that up and up and up until now I don't even think there was a war for them to be veterans of, so they just don't talk about it anymore. DC, of course, is much more grounded in history and legacy, and therefore they're constantly trying to find, well, this character was around in the 1940s, this character was around in the 50s, and blah, blah, blah. Captain America is one of the only guys you can do that with because he's so explicitly a product of the 1940s, and then he, of course, is unmoored from that time period and then placed into a modern context whenever that modernity happens to be at the date of publication. So even though he has that heritage as a 1940s character, it's always about him being a 1940s character in modern times, less so than it is about telling stories about what he did in the 40s and what he did over the successive decades, in the same way that DC, you know, they've got multi-generational heroes, and this person's the grandson of this person, and this is where this guy was in 1973, and that kind of stuff. Regardless, the point is, Batmite don't belong in no Batman stories. Batmite was one of the characters that was in the issue of Who's Who that was being covered in a given month, and as per the inclinations of, in the early days, I wanted to find some goofy, punny thing to dump as much Batman stuff that I didn't want to deal with as possible into one place, and so Batmite was lumped in with all this other Batman paraphernalia and loose associations into a team book. It was a throwaway that was informed by some of the other stuff that happened around the same time period, but mostly it's just a joke that played out until probably longer than it needed to. Ditto my Batgirl's proposal.
January, you start the year off fine. February, you're my little Valentine. March, I'm gonna march you down the aisle. April, you're the Easter bunny when you smile. We think you're special. 21st Century Boys, Bobby Nash, Dr. Ant, Artificial Twins, Brad Lonard, Bronze Age Babies, Capital Gingham, Chris Dunford, Chris Lydon, Cooper Edmonds, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Ed Moore, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geek, E-Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hicks, Isaac, JMT Prod, Julia Raul, Kailash Dwala McKee, Writer and Media in Charge, Martin Gray, Maxo, Midnight 693, Men, Mike It Send Aliens to Me, My Comic Book Collection 70s to 90s, Nathaniel Devon Mason Sanford, Petrus Gaspard, Richard Field, Roger Preby, Ronald Clark, Scott X, Sean McLaughlin, Sean Phillips, Speaker of the House Kirk Spencer, Superbound, Tiny Tim Price, The Podcrasher, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey RPG Podcast, and Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace Podcast.
The preceding program is a nonprofit fan production. Any copyrighted materials contained therein are believed borrowed under fair use with no copyright infringement intended. Please feel free to leave comments at the Rolled Spine Productions WordPress blog. You can also send us Twitter comments through the Rolled Spine Podcast Twitter. Thank you for listening.